Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Good morning and welcome to Out the Box. For minds that don't fit the mold, but hearts that keep striving. I'm Simone Herring. Last week, in the first of our autism series, we spoke to author, educator, and autism advocate Ilana Gershlovitz. We drew on her professional experience as well as her personal journey as the mother of a son with profound autism to help us better understand the autism spectrum disorder. We recognized that there were early warning signs and we spoke about navigating the diagnosis process. We learned that autism is a neurodevelopmental condition that affects communication, social interaction, and behavior, and that every autistic individual is unique. We also discussed some of the early red flags that may warrant further investigation, including limited eye contact, delayed speech and language development, not consistently responding to their name, difficulties with social interaction, and repetitive behaviors and sensory differences. If you missed that conversation, I honestly encourage you to go and catch up on that episode on the Chai FM podcast page, where you'll find the full interview available on demand. Today, we're taking the journey to the next level. We're going to be exploring co-occurring conditions or comorbidities, the additional challenges that often accompany autism, including sleep difficulties, gastrointestinal issues, anxiety, ADHD, and sensory processing differences. Ilana, welcome once again for episode 2 on Out the Box.
So exciting to be out today.
We really had a brilliant conversation, and I think we opened up and we laid the scaffolding for autism. But we are going to take it further because there is so much to discuss and there are so many different facets. Firstly, I want you to help us understand what professionals mean when they talk about co-occurring conditions or comorbidities.
When a child is diagnosed with autism, there are many comorbidities that the child and the family are faced with. These include food allergies. The child could not be sleeping. If the child's not sleeping, the mom is not sleeping, the dad's not sleeping, everyone is absolutely exhausted. They have immune issues. They can have many different kinds of allergies. And so these gut issues, as you said, gastrointestinal issues play a very big role when it comes to the autism diagnosis. So we can unpack that today.
And isn't it so that even with people who have autoimmune, there's so much inflammation and the gut relates to inflammation within the body. So one would think that it would affect autism as well.
Autism is a brain on fire. It's a gut that has inflammation. The microbiome, which is the gut flora, is compromised. And we know for a fact there are many peer-reviewed published papers in support of the gut-brain connection in autism and actually in ADHD as well.
Yes.
That we know about.
But very difficult to implement, especially if you're a mom dealing with more than one child and children on the spectrum. It's quite overwhelming. But we'll get to that when we speak to David's story and how you tackled the gut-brain issue. So I just wanted to clarify for the listeners that when we talk about the co-occurring condition, that's what Ilana has just referred to in terms of the gut and the allergies, the sleep, etc. We're also going to talk about those comorbidities which occur with autism, which are things like ADHD. I mean, who would think that you would get a double whammy like that with ADHD and learning difficulties, etc.? Okay. Let's start with one of the most common challenges that families talk about, and that's sleep. We all know what it is to be sleep deprived as our children are babies. But David took this to a different level.
we were exhausted. Martin used to drive his car and almost have an accident because he'd be falling asleep at the wheel. David honestly didn't sleep for 5 years straight. And it took us a very long time to work out what was going on. But 20 years later, I always tell parents, I've already watched the movie of autism, so I know what's going to happen and I know what's causing a lot of the symptoms. And so we can really talk about sleep and what's causing the child to wake up at night. I've got a long list of, items that parents should discuss with their doctor. So, for example, if it's in a young developing toddler, do they maybe have an ear infection? They have now an autism diagnosis, or you suspect an autism diagnosis, the child's not sleeping at night. What can the parents look at to try and get them back into a sleep routine? Number one, go to the ENT, check the ears. Number two, food allergies. Gluten and dairy can be a problem. Number three, yeast, candida in the gut can keep the child up at night. Number four, deficiency in vitamin B6 and magnesium absolutely can keep the child up at night. Number five would be melatonin. So melatonin is a fantastic supplement that I used with both my children, and especially with David. That did help. It helps you to fall to sleep and stay to sleep. And when children on the spectrum have metabolic imbalances, which many of them do, they're not making enough melatonin. That's why we get tired at night. Our body naturally makes melatonin. So melatonin supplement is something for you to discuss with your doctor.
And that's something, from what I'm hearing, that's something that's common in children with autism, is that lack of melatonin. Am I correct?
Yes. So metabolically, they have many imbalances. And if we look at, this is just in my layman mom's understanding, A makes B makes C makes D makes melatonin. So you've really got to be working with a metabolic specialist to go back in the chain to see why are they at the end of the day not producing the melatonin. But melatonin, there's another option, a natural herbal called, 5-HTP. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with that. That's another thing that you can discuss with your pediatrician. Don't go and run and do anything without consulting your doctor.
So that's what I really love about you, Lana, is that you have so much experience, and we always say that moms at the end of the day have earned their MBBCH, you know. I say to my mom, you know, you're just dosing me up. Do you actually know what you're doing? She says, well, phone the doctor and you'll see. He'll tell you the exact same thing. But what I really appreciate is in a situation like this, when things are so serious, you always refer back to the medical doctors. And you're not making decisions alone. Your decisions are, you know, coinciding what doctors have to say. And I think that's important for parents to hear.
Very much.
We're not just giving advice. We are saying that we are lay people, and you are speaking as a mom and someone who has researched autism to the nth degree. But again, it's important to speak to your medical doctors. So you're saying that falling asleep, staying asleep, going back to sleep is something that really would affect a child with autism. Now, we know that poor sleep can then affect things like learning, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And the child's concentration.
A child who's not eating properly and not sleeping properly cannot learn.
Right. And I often refer back to the children that come from poverty-stricken backgrounds and they come to school hungry. We used to give them sandwiches in the morning because you cannot learn if you have not fed your body. Okay, so going back to all these co-difficulties that have been, you know, have been put out there, as you said, that the sleep difficulty was one of the biggest challenges for your family, and so you began to look at why he wasn't sleeping. You didn't just put it down to, oh, he's a baby and toddler and they just don't sleep. Can you take us through the journey and explain to us what David's experience taught you about sleep difficulties?
The child is waking up for a reason. There's something bothering them. You know, there's an underlying medical issue that you do need to find and treat.
Yes.
That's what David taught us. Not only would he wake up in the middle of the night, but then he'd fall back to sleep. And then in the morning when he did wake up, You know how he'd wake up someone, I'd hear him banging his head against the wall because he had self-injurious behavior. You know, some children with autism can hit their head on the floor and on the wall so much that they need to put a helmet on because they can cause concussion. I remember just waking up myself to this thumping on the wall, you know, which was very, very distressing. Honestly, I think that went on for 5 years. What I learned much later, because it takes you time to go from one medical professional to the other, is that actually anti-inflammatories help David stop his self-injurious behavior because there's inflammation in the brain.
Very interesting. I have a question. This is a pre-recording. I just wanted everybody to know because next week I am on a course, so Ilana came in for the pre-recording, so you won't be able to send your WhatsApps on the live show. But afterwards, I want you to send your WhatsApps and tell us, has your child struggled with sleep difficulties? We'd really love to hear your story and what helped your family the most.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Welcome back to Out the Box. We're speaking to Ilana Gershlovitz about autism, her experience, her writing a book called Saving My Sons. And just as I always like to do, bring information to parents because information is empowering. What I do like, and I've said this before, is that, Ilana, you always talk about parents trusting their instincts. So you ask them to ask questions. What other types of ways, if you know something is amiss and they're not just saying to you, oh, well, that's the autism, you saying, let me look for something else. What do you advise parents to do? What are the things that, for example, could be niggling you? You know, your child is autistic and then you discovered, well, it's an ear problem or it's a gastrointestinal problem. How do parents go about this? They have received this devastating diagnosis and then all these other things crop up.
Well, I always say that if you read one thing every day to help your child and you read about or you watch a video clip about some treatment for autism or special learning needs, if you take 5 minutes every day to learn something new, just think about it. In 365 days, you've learned 365 new things that can help your child get better.
Right.
You need to consult with doctors who can ask the why question. Mm. That took me many years to discover. Mm. If your doctor can't ask, why is my child not sleeping? Or why is my child not eating? Or why is my child not speaking? It's the wrong doctor. Mm. You have to work with the doctor who's going to ask why. Mm.
And listen to the mother, which I found that my pediatrician many, many years ago said, I always listen to the mother.
You have to listen to the mother and you have to follow your instinct. As you mentioned, Simone, something's niggly. You're worried about the child. What do you do? You have to dig. You have to research. Mm. You have to investigate. If one doctor doesn't give you the answer, go to another doctor. If that doctor doesn't give you the answer, go to another doctor.
Yes.
You know, if one educator doesn't give you the answer, find an educator that will. You have to keep going.
Keep going. Again, beyond the behavior and understanding the gastrointestinal challenges as well as the sensory ones in autism, these gastrointestinal issues are very, very complex but also very common in autistic children. Can you tell us about the types of gastrointestinal issues that crop up? What kind of things?
I'm so happy you raised this, Simone, and it's so, so important to be talking about this. When we ended episode one, I was talking about how psychiatric medication in my research is not the first line of treatment. Absolutely has its place after you've exhausted a long list of possibilities, but certainly not the first port of call. Let's talk about the gastrointestinal issues. So first of all, we know that children on the spectrum, children who've got anxiety, children who've got sensory issues have got food allergies. I would recommend that the parents focus on the nutrition, gluten, dairy, soy, sugar free. There is allergy testing you can do. That's for another day, a very, very long conversation. But it's not the biggest exercise to remove gluten and dairy. I always say to the parents, make chicken soup. Many years ago, Martin was...
You said you perfected the recipe in your book.
Yes.
Am I right? It perfected the recipe for chicken soup.
Absolutely. Your listeners can contact me for my chicken soup recipe. But many years ago, Martin was at one of the autism conferences in America. I'm talking 20 years ago. He waited 45 minutes to speak to the top neurologist at the time from Harvard University, Professor Martha Herbert. She'd written 3 books on autism. And when he got to the front, he said, Professor Herbert, please help me. My son is 3 years old and he's not speaking and he's not sleeping and he's not eating. What must we do?
Right.
And she said, make chicken soup. Nutrition, nutrition, nutrition.
Right. Protein, it sounds like protein is really important.
Protein is important, so every meal should have a protein and a carbohydrate.
Okay. In terms of in the book, you spoke about David having terrible stomach ache. That was, you know, excruciating for him. Are those things related to reflux, constipation, bloating? What?
Yes, 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 yes. All of that, you know. The therapist will say the child is hanging upside down and needs proprioceptive, vestibular input. But the child needs gastrointestinal treatment. They need to get to a doctor, a pediatrician, a gastroenterologist who's going to do investigations into the gut, into the microbiome. Children on the spectrum have candida, yeast, and bacterial infection. That needs to be treated over a period of time. We need to replace the good gut flora. They need to go on nutritious diets. A lot of them are picky eaters, and the parents will feel like their back is up against the wall. We're cornered. They'll only eat pizza, chips, Coke, and McDonald's.
Mm.
Well, we have to work through this and support that family and that child, because if we don't get the nutrition right, we're not going to be able to address the sensory issues, the anxiety, a lack of progress, learning, speech development. Nutrition is really the foundational work. Let's just think about it. We eat food, we digest the food, we extract essential vitamins and minerals, and that's how we support the brain.
Yes, yes, I agree wholeheartedly. You know, it did sound like David was in a lot of pain, and you also then spoke about him having a colonoscopy. What was the reason for that? And how old was he, by the way? Can you tell the listeners how old he was when he went through a colonoscopy?
David had stomach pain, and so do many, many young developing toddlers who've just plunged into autism. Autism is a gut-brain connection. We can treat this condition by looking at the gut and trying to heal the gut. With David, we were still learning. It was like, you know, sadly, I think he did suffer a lot from his tummy. He had explosive stools. He had 11 stools a day as a 3-year-old. They were slimy. They were runny. He was bloated. Mm. His stomach was extended. And the doctors kind of dismissed me. Mm. I flew to one of the top, neurologists in Bloemfontein. And I'll never forget, I walked away with psychiatric medication when he should have been looking at David's gut.
Yeah.
Because the children who are diagnosed with autism are medically ill. They're sick. This is not a psychiatric disorder. That's why, Simone, last episode we were talking about the DSM and how autism is defined. And in America, they are working towards removing autism from the DSM, from the psychiatric manual, because it is a digestive disorder, a metabolic disorder, and an immune issue.
Yes. And you have to look at the whole child, you know. Don't just look at the autism. There's so many things that come with it. And look at the whole child. And I appreciate it when doctors, as you said, medication has its place. But I also appreciate it when doctors say, let's look at the diet and let's look at the symptoms that he's experiencing and let's see what happens. So what did that colonoscopy tell you about David?
the colonoscopy, always very anxiety provoking for parents, you know, the day before preparing a young child to clear out his bowel before went for the colonoscopy, very anxious about it. And it actually showed that David was suffering from inflammation in the ileum and the colon, which is very, very common in children on the spectrum. He had inflammation throughout, and, you know, he had to go onto high dose cortisone. And that's when we really saw a turning point. I think he was 5 years old, so that took us a couple of years to reach that point, right. Unfortunately. Yeah. Again, the top, so-called top neurologists, like in Bloemfontein, telling me, put him on psychiatric medication. As a parent, we had to learn on the job.
Yeah.
A few years later, only doing a colonoscopy to discover very serious inflammation in the bowel that needs to be treated.
And often the treatment is not mind-blowingly medically amazing. It's like simple things, like you said, adding a vitamin. Or I was speaking to somebody yesterday who is a psychiatrist, and just like trying to get a perspective on what role psychiatry does play. And he said that folate was quite a big thing with autistic children, not just folic acid where moms take that in the, you know, while they're pregnant, but he spoke about folate because it doesn't cross the brain barrier. Now, I was trying to understand that, and as I say, you know, I'm really a layperson in all of this, but that folate is really important. Why is folate so essential?
There are, thankfully, medical professionals in America over the last 30 years who have done research, medical doctors who've had their own autistic children who've said, we will not stand for this. Mm. We will not take this. We will fight for a better future for our children. Our children are suffering. Something's wrong. They're not medically well.
Yes.
And they've trailblazed. And, you know, the rest of the world kind of comes afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
They get onto the bandwagon a little bit later. And so they really have, there are research papers in support of children with autism. There's a group of them. The doctor is Dr. Richard Fry. He did a lot of work on cerebral folate deficiency and autism. So your listeners can go and look for his papers, Dr. Richard Fry. And he discovered that there are children that are metabolically not producing enough folate or folinic acid. Okay. So it is also linked to what we call methylation, MTHFR. Those are the genes that are responsible to make B12 and folinic acid. In children on the spectrum, often methylation is compromised, and that is why they're sluggish in producing folinic acid or folate. So let's say you should produce 100% of folate or folinic acid. They're only producing 40%. So if you supplement, you see improvement in speech, behavior, language.
Absolutely.
But it's not all the children. There's some children.
Absolutely. And not every challenge is just autism itself. It may link to autism, but it is looking at the reasons for, like you said, with the folate, and they're not producing their own. There are other things other than just throwing medication at the child. Although, as I say, medication definitely has its place, and so do you. We'll be back.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Welcome back. You're listening to Out the Box on Chai FM 101.9. We're speaking to the lovely Ilana Gershlovitz, who is unpacking autism for us. And as I previously said, we had episode 1 this week. This is a pre-recording, but I urge you all to go and listen to episode 1 if you haven't yet already. Ilana, we were talking about the folate and the methylation. Can you just go back to that methylation part? Because I know that within the brain, you know, we've experienced people who've had brain tumors, for example, and they always ask, is it methylated or is it unmethylated? And I always find that very confusing.
What I can tell you, Simone, is that my youngest, Aaron, just to give you my personal experience to answer the folate question.
And that's what parents really want to hear.
Yeah. Aaron was developing normally. At 17 months, we saw a regression. He'd gone in for grommets. He'd had an anesthetic. It was nitrous oxide. He had gas. And the next thing, he regresses into autism. He loses his speech, his eye contact, starts running in circles and spinning the wheels of a car. What I understood from my research is that he had genetically impaired detoxification, genetically impaired methylation. And so when he got that environmental trigger, remember, how does autism evolve? It's pregenetic vulnerability coupled with environmental triggers. So yes, what triggers can be a little bit different for every child. So for Aaron, when he got that anesthetic, he struggled to detox, and the anesthetic remained in his brain and caused an inflammatory response and also affected his methylation. So he was making less folinic acid and he couldn't detox. When I realized that we'd lost Aaron, and very quickly, like literally that afternoon after his anesthetic, we had already been 10 years into our journey fighting autism because of my older son, David. I had access to the right medical professionals in America, and I contacted one of the doctors, and they immediately suggested that I supplement Aaron with folate and explain to me, let's help him detox, let's get him onto a proper folate supplement to help methylation. And I gave him B12 injections as well. There is a published paper by Dr. Newbrander 20 years ago on subcutaneous B12 injections and autism, and how that helps speech motor planning, coupled with folinic acid or folate. And we gave Aaron at a very young age of 20 months subcutaneous B12 injections and a folate supplementation, and within a couple of days after starting, he started to turn his voice back on. If you read my book, one of the therapists who were working with Aaron documents her experience working with Aaron, and she says, we'd been working for a few months, he hadn't said anything, and then I said to him, say ba, and all of a sudden I heard a come out of his lips.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you correct the underlying medical causes of what's blocking the child from being able to speech motor plan, for example, it's not something that the child just fixes overnight. It then requires rehabilitative therapy, and that's where our ABA at Star Academy comes in.
And you spoke about learning, almost like learning to walk again. You have to learn to talk again, and the effects of this motor planning that you mentioned in the last episode.
Simone, we were sitting on the floor in my therapy room at my house, and the therapist working with Aaron, who was ABA trained.
Can you just explain ABA briefly for the listeners?
So ABA is applied behavior analysis, methodology of teaching, rooted in psychology, first line treatment for children with autism. It incorporates teaching strategy. It's the how do we teach. Coupled with the ABA, we follow a very, very comprehensive developmental curriculum that covers motor, language, cognition, play skills, academic skills, adaptive skills, so executive functioning skills. So you have a curriculum that you follow coupled with a methodology of teaching to teach missing skills. Children who've got missing skills are going to present with behavior. What drives challenging behavior, and we can have a whole episode just on challenging behavior, is missing skills. So there we were sitting in my therapy room at my house, and we were working on Aaron's motor planning for speech. And he said the sound B, but he only used the side of his mouth, and he couldn't use the other side of his mouth. Like, it came out of the right side of his mouth, but you could see that he couldn't move the left side of his mouth.
Yes.
And when I saw it, I froze, and I gasped. And the therapist sitting on the floor calmed me down, and she said, I saw that. I saw what you saw. Calm down. We're going to get him to use both sides of his mouth. And Aaron is in grade 8 today at King David, and he's preparing for his exams next week. And I'm so grateful to Hashem, Baruch Hashem, that we have the miracle called Aaron.
Unbelievable. Somebody once said to me, he was very, very ill. And I said to him, you know, did God have a hand in it? And I'm talking very, very ill. And he said, well, the doctors had the hand that I needed. And I said, yes, but Hashem guided that hand. And he thought about it, and he said, you know what? You're right. Because every atheist becomes a believer when they're in the trenches. And that's what I really, really do think. And I think that you were, with your faith, you were really guided by Hashem. And you did what you did because you had the strength and the capacity, even though you were falling apart.
Hashem gave me the strength, you know, to think that I wrote a book, and I wrote the book. I didn't write the book. Hashem guided my hand. What did I learn along this journey? You really need to know darkness before you can appreciate light.
Called comfort in a way, but yes, you're absolutely right, is that you have to experience loss, and I mean loss in a very wide kind of loss, in a wide kind of thought process. Like, you lost your child.
I lost my child. It was like a living death.
Yeah.
And our heart was broken. The pieces were on the floor. Yeah. But Simone, over the years, we learned to make a beautiful mosaic and put the pieces back together.
Yeah. And well done to both you and Martin as parents, because your child is now, as you said, in grade 8 at a mainstream school, preparing for exams. From losing him at a very, very early stage. I mean, how old was he when he had?
He was 17 months when we lost him. And then, of course, there's David, who's profoundly autistic. And, you know, we've learned so many lessons along that journey. And there have been many victories along the way. But we are his caregiver and not his parent.
Yeah.
And then just to mention, you know, the first episode, I was telling everybody that Erin made a 365 autism. And we were talking about, well, can you lose a diagnosis of autism? And I said, you absolutely can. And you asked me, but has he, Lana? Has he lost his symptoms?
It's hard to comprehend that, Ilana. Like, you know, to comprehend that a child loses this overwhelming diagnosis. When you look at David and, you know, it took so much for you to get to the point that you are with David.
Yes, so there's a few things that I want to say. So with Erin, every year he actually has tests with the American clinicians. We collaborate with the American-based Center for Autism and Related Disorders. And pretty much every year they would conduct standardized testing for him to make sure that he's still is maintaining, you know, especially when he moved from to middle school. They call it middle school in America, you know, senior primary.
Yes.
But he would have the top, the clinical director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders, you know, because I have such a long-term relationship with them, would do standardized testing for Erin to check on his language and his social skills. And so, again, I'm going to tell your listeners today, you can have children who have skills that may need to be polished. It doesn't mean you have enough criteria for an autism diagnosis, and that's been blurred, Simone.
Well, I also think that kind of, you know, I'm not sure what the word is, but it always diminishes the true diagnosis of autism and what parents are going through, because, as you said, there's this spectrum. And initially, I think the spectrum did make sense, but it became very blurred because now we're finding autism in everybody. And if you've got social difficulties, you're on the spectrum. And when I was speaking to the psychiatrist yesterday, he said to me that spectrum has actually blurred the lines and it needs to be re-looked at.
Absolutely. It will be changed in the near future. Yeah. They are working on that. I've mentioned to you that I absolutely love Robert Kennedy in America. He's the health secretary, and he is doing amazing things for autism. He came out and said autism is a horrible diagnosis. He took so much flack for it. I was cheering. He came out and said, let's look at vaccines again. I was cheering. You know, he stood next to Trump, and Trump said, what did Trump say when it comes to vaccines? Listen to the mothers.
Yeah.
Listen to the mothers who said my child had a vaccine and regressed. There's something there. Listen to them. I don't know why everyone has to get so upset just because we have to say, let's go look at it again.
So, Ilana, that's quite controversial. I mean, I know that the vaccines are very controversial. And in fact, I asked you on the last episode, I said, but Ilana, they have the vaccine at the stage where autism presents. which is what, like 17 or 18 months old. So are you just looking at it because the two correlate? And if you're saying that there is the chance that a vaccine can affect and or trigger, as you said, autism, what about countries like Sweden? I mean, I'm not sure if it is Sweden or Switzerland. I say that very cautiously. But they give their vaccines at different ages.
You ask good questions. You really do. Vaccines are absolutely necessary because we have managed over many years to eradicate many childhood illnesses which would cause many deaths.
Mm.
However, people miss that we really need safe vaccination, and that the debate is not about should we vaccinate or shouldn't we vaccinate, but the debate should really be about ensuring safe vaccination. And Simone, our vaccines are unfortunately not safe. I challenge any of your listeners to email me or comment and send us the papers in support of showing that childhood vaccines are safe. Please send that to me, number one. The other issue is that when we talk about why can vaccines not be safe, what are the preservatives? No percentage of mercury and lead that are preservatives in vaccines can be safe. We have polysorbate in vaccines that cannot be safe. We have multiple shots, which we shouldn't have. Why must we do measles, mumps, rubella? Why can't we do single vaccines? And what is the contents of the vaccine? Ask your pediatrician, what are the contents of the vaccine? I'm not sure they know.
So we've been going quite controversial. And what I like about Ilana is she is controversial, and I love that, but she is open to debate. And I think that this is an area, medication and vaccines, that we are definitely going to spend an episode on. And we will invite a pediatric neurologist or a psychiatrist. You know, I think the pediatric neurologist is the most important person to go to first. We are just going to take a quick break, and we'll be back.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
I'm Simone Herring, and sitting with me in the studio doing a pre-recording is Ilana Gershlovitz. So please do send your questions, your suggestions, your comments, as I know it is after this actual recording, but we will address them in the next episode. So WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. We look forward to hearing from you. So Ilana, like, I was a bit nervous about doing this controversial stuff. And I thought to myself, sure, it's on radio. We're giving out information. And a lot of people get swept away with information. So I just want to clarify that you are always open to debate. And everything has, you know, there can be two truths that hold the same power, and we are the ones that need to create that debate. Moving on now to the sensory stuff, and why autistic children do suffer from such sensory, proprioceptive difficulties.
I'm going to answer the sensory question. Just quickly before we move away from the vaccines, just remember vaccines are necessary, and you must please discuss your vaccine schedule with your pediatrician and not make any decisions just from listening to this conversation.
Or anything else
today.
Or any other conversation.
There is a book called Making the Vaccine Choice, written by Dr. Robert Sears, that you can buy for informative purposes, but remember to always consult your doctor.
I appreciate that. Okay. And I'm sure our listeners do too.
Yes. Okay. So now, sensory issues. No amount of therapy is going to alleviate sensory dysregulation unless we treat the gut-brain issue and the true underlying medical causes of what's driving the sensory dysregulation. A young developing child processes information coming in from the environment through their senses. their touch, their taste, visual, auditory. And in a young developing child, when there's an environmental trigger that affects their genetics, we then see sensory dysregulation, and that obviously impairs their ability to learn from the environment. And in a young developing child, it's very, very important everyday learning, because they like a sponge. So they're soaking, taking in everything that they're learning. And Simone, I'm so happy we're talking about this, because autism actually evolves because they're building blocks to childhood development. Mm-hmm. At the Star Academy, we've been trained in childhood development. If you truly understand childhood development, I always say we're childhood developmental engineers, then you'll understand why a child at 5 and 7 presents with autism symptoms and in their teenage years. One developmental skill builds on another. Every year a child has a birthday, more and more is expected of them developmentally. So autism is not this thing that you're born with. Autism is an event that happens that interrupts your development. And as the years go by, if your developmental skills that you delayed in are not caught up, because one building block depends on another.
Yes.
If we don't catch up those skills that are missing from a young developing child, we're going to see autism symptoms later on. And it's not always so easy to catch them all up, okay? But we need to work towards doing that.
Okay.
I can see that as well with Erin, where, you know, many young children, and they immediately stimulate to environmental noise. Like a young child, if there's a dog barking, they'll turn around and look. Mm. So Erin wasn't doing that. Erin wasn't studying people's faces and looking at adults having a conversation, learning from that scenario at 18 months and 2. So you can imagine that further down the line, when a child is 7 and 8 years old, when they've missed out on those foundational skills as a young developing child, they can have skills that they need to polish as they go through development. But eventually they do catch up. Eventually they do catch up. Okay, now I haven't answered your question, which was relating to sensory issues. But let's get back there. You have to treat the gut to treat the sensory dysregulation. And I can give you some examples. For example, there are children who are sensitive to loud noise. They could be magnesium or zinc deficient. This is fact.
Okay.
We have children who are picky eaters. They are sensitive to the texture of food. The first thing you look at is there a zinc deficiency? When we're talking sensory issues, we got to look at the gut, what's happening in the gut, what food allergies are there. There's a test called the organic acid test. It is available in South Africa. There's a laboratory in South Africa called the Biometrics Lab that runs the organic acid test. This is very good as a urine test to check for fungus and bacteria in the gut. It checks inflammatory markers. It looks at vitamin and mineral levels. And there are 72 markers that you can rely on to try and work out, why is my child sensory dysregulated? What is driving these sensory issues? And this organic acid test, it must be interpreted by a medical professional who's trained. But if you start treating, what you find, the children can improve and do improve very much when it comes to sensory dysregulation. My son, Aaron, I had a clinician from America who is very trained in speech motor planning. She saw him from New York. I flew her to South Africa for 5 years to train my staff. She saw Erin for the first time and she said, Alana, in her American accent, Alana, he has sensory dysregulation. And how did we beat sensory dysregulation? Diet, correcting metabolic imbalances, correcting the gut-brain connection.
So that speaks back to your first statement, which you said that no amount of therapy can solve sensory issues. I just want to move to things like noise, bright lights, you know, the textures of clothing, the food textures that you mentioned, and certain smells. Often a child will have a major meltdown because he's in a situation that he can't process all the sensory stuff that's going around. And it can happen in a split second. He can be happily playing and then all of a sudden something triggers that. How does one cope with those meltdowns? How do you calm the child if he's having this, you know, sensory dysregulation episode? How do you calm a child?
Good question. At the Star Academy, we found the missing skills that's driving the meltdown. And we desensitize the children to those sensory issues.
Okay, that's...
We want them to live in our world.
Yes. There kind of is a question that I have around that, and I'm going to come back to that after this.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Ilana, you know, we only have 5 more minutes left of the show, and I feel like we haven't even touched on what I wanted to talk about. We will take it into the next episode. But very quickly, you said that we want our children to adjust to the world. You know, in a way, I believe it, but in another way, I feel like the world should adjust to our children. What is your feeling on that?
I love that we can debate this. My feeling is that our Jewish schools and the remedial schools need to get with the times. We need to teach the children the skills they're missing and not tailor the environment to the child. We need to tailor the child to the environment, especially in the younger years, especially when they're in grade R and grade one. They're so quick to send the children off to a remedial setting. We've learned the American way. They are looking for solutions. And I have seen over 20 years where we've enabled and empowered children to learn the skills that they're missing so that they can cope in any learning environment and don't require a tailored learning environment. For those children who do land up at the end of the day requiring a tailored learning environment, absolutely. And there will be that group of children. And so, Simone, see, I agree with you also. There is going to be that group of children. You know, they're going to be 15 and 16 up where we must accept them into the community and into our inclusive, and we'll talk about inclusive education. But in a young developing child, in a child who's grade R and grade one, we should not be sending them to any remedial setting.
You know, Ilana, I appreciate everything that you've been saying. And I think that I love, again, that you're open to debate. I just wanted to end off. Well, I wanted to address the self-injurious behavior, and I'm definitely going to do that in the next, because that is very frightening. But many of you know Temple Grandin's story, and what she has taught us about sensory processing is that touch in autistic individuals can be very, very difficult. And for her, she needed strong sensory input. She was very proprioceptive, and she really needed, and how she discovered that she calmed down when she had that strong sensory input. And so she calmed cattle down, which was quite fascinating. And I really do ask parents to go and listen to her, because she's very, very interesting. And, you know, I know that she's become very popularized, etc., but it is definitely, she is one of the world's biggest advocates, and I think that you should go and listen. I'm so sad to have to end off, and what I do want to say is that we are going to come back for episode 4 and 5, where we're going to touch on how autism affects families, we're going to touch on diet, and we're going to touch on the self-injurious behavior and puberty. One never ever thinks about puberty. So, Ilana, thanks again for joining us, and I look forward to the next session. And I implore everybody to please go and listen to the first episode. We're going to end off with a song, Heal the World, and I think that is just so apt for the discussion that we're having today. So, until then, We'll see all of you on Out the Box for episode 3.